Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
We're back. Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and my website is www.jbsba.com. Thank you very much for hanging around with us today, and I'm excited about having Jim Ostrop back on the show. Jim's an old friend of ours. He's sitting in for Joan Pride today. He's associate editor of the Kiplinger Washington Editors, and he's a great American. Jim Ostrop, welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Jim, and thank you.
It's good to have you here.
Always good to join you.
It's like a dream come true for you, isn't it, to be back on my show?
Or a nightmare. No, it is a dream. Absolutely. It is a dream. Always happy to chat with you and the many, many listeners. It's a pleasure.
Jim, there's some interesting things going on out there that you guys reported on this week about what's happening with the relationship between the federal government and the state government. What's happening? Is there a states' rights revolt going on?
Not so much a states' rights revolt, but it's just coming, basically this, coming to one of those periods where many states feel they need to try something different with respect to situations or problems. I mean, we've heard, of course, about some states saying, okay, we're going to go and find a way to import some drugs from, prescription drugs from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
But they're doing other things as well. For instance, Maine trying out universal health care.
Well, that they tried that in Oregon, too, and it didn't pass.
Right. No, that's right. It didn't. But it's just one of these periods where you might just say that states feel they need to try some things on their own. And the thing is that you often find that the states are ahead of activities by the federal government, and the federal government falls in place. I mean, you can go back even now just about 70 years to the 1930s when you had some states offer unemployment insurance, mm-hmm. and basically it was some type of bank insurance, and of course eventually the federal government stepped in and tried that.
So basically the states are sort of like incubators for ideas. They're bellwethers, if you will.
They're bellwethers in showing at least where things are headed. Not that they'll actually come to fruition. There are some things where states just turn it aside.
Right.
Or ultimately the federal government turns it aside, the people turn it aside. So.
Well, what's interesting is Maine is, up there near Canada.
Right.
And Canada has a single-payer health care system, right?
That's correct, right.
And it's not a very good one. It's not a really good one. And yet Maine wants to, they seem to be trying to head towards universal health insurance.
What
is it about their neighbor that's going on in their neighbor's health care situation that they don't get?
I suppose that it's, might say, really, the lawmakers of Maine are looking to try something else. They figure they feel they must move to offer health care insurance to every state member, and are looking to plan something like Canada. And say, well, we know it's not perfect, but it does work because it operates from day to day. So let's try this.
Well, and Maine is a red state. A blue state. Let's not forget that. It is not only red. It's very red. And there are other things that the states are doing though. There are some other issues. 11 northeastern states, which are a lot of red states, are working on limiting emissions of carbon dioxide, aren't they?
They are, and I guess this is an area where Kiplinger feels that, not only are the states ahead of the federal government, but in fact are a true and accurate bellwether of mm-hmm. what's going to happen. Somewhere by the end of this decade, we do expect the federal government to move to limit carbon dioxide emissions, and that will be very significant for many businesses.
Mm-hmm. But still not join the Kyoto Accords.
unlikely.
I hope not. I hope not. I certainly think that for the United States to be part of the Kyoto, I think the Kyoto Accords is nothing less than an ambush for the United States.
There are many pitfalls in it for the United States, as well as a few other developed nations.
But pitfalls, most of the pitfalls are going to be unique to the United States. It wouldn't be a problem for Russia, it wouldn't be a problem for Europe, it wouldn't be a problem for China.
Now, in many cases, it is unique or much worse for the U.S. But the critical thing is that, as it stands now, Kyoto basically exempts some of the world's largest individual polluters,
like India and China.
And China. They are exempt because they're developing.
They're considered to be third world type of marketplaces.
No, that's right. And even if, as we know, China has an ability, U.S. companies count on China to turn out world-class consumer goods.
Right.
They're still a developing country.
Well, and so, and they have a lot of two-cycle engines in those countries that are tremendous polluters.
They do, and it's also just even with respect to China, different paradigm where they don't have the electricity infrastructure.
Right.
So in many cases, you might say fossil fuels or gasoline or diesel substitutes as a power source,
right,
where they just
right.
have a generator here, a generator there. It is extremely inefficient, and no question. I mean, China is the world's largest polluter.
The Kyoto Accords for the United States, in my opinion, folks. And this is what we got off of this, talking about what some of the states are doing to move towards those kinds of emission standards. It's a loser for the United States, for our economy. 29 after, right back with Jim Ostroff after these messages. The show is brought to you by IBM and Office Depot.
And now, back to a man who didn't let being named one of the 100 most important radio talk show hosts in America go to his head.
Woo! Woo! Yes! In your face!
He's Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate.
We're back. It's 34 after the hour. Thank you very much for hanging around with me. If you just tuned in, welcome aboard. My website is www.jbsba.com. And when you get there, if you look over on the Brain Trust section and you look over on the alphabetical section of the Brain Trust and you scroll down a little bit to the O's, you'll find our guest, Jim Ostroff, well represented and proudly. We are proud to have him represented as a member of our Brain Trust. You can also listen to some of the archives of past shows that he and I have heard. So if you just can't get enough of his lilting voice, you can go back and find him over and over and over again on our website in the archives. And Jim Ostroff, who's, by the way, is associate editor with the Kipling Editors, thank you for your time today.
Good morning again.
Jim, the one quick note on this, the 11 northeastern states that are working on limiting emissions of carbon dioxide. You and I got off on our soapbox about Kyoto, but the thing is, the truth is these 11 states, and I'm going to give them, as I think you were doing a little bit, maybe give them a little credit for focusing on this so that we have our own version of Kyoto compliance without being dictated to by the rest of the planet. Is that where you see it?
That is actually a very good point, and that you might say here, we're, as so often the case, I mean, the states and then the government find our way to a workable solution, one that does not derail the economy, whether big business or small business, does not overturn the apple cart in terms of people's ways of life. They're doing this in a more sensible way, and fact is, what they're doing is saying, we feel this is an important public policy goal. How are we going to do it? We are going to let the marketplace, the free market, work it out with various, basically, emissions credits.
Anytime you let the marketplace solve its own problems,
its own
challenges, sometimes we have to put a little pressure on the marketplace. Sometimes people don't act in the right way initially, but when the marketplace is allowed to filter itself, the result is a lot purer, isn't it?
It's pure, and it's more efficient, and you might say, and less costly overall. It is less disruptive. Friday, basically a new exchange opened up. We have a coffee exchange, we have essentially oil exchange in the NYMEX, and now we have a sulfur dioxide credit exchange that just opened in Chicago last week.
Hmm.
And it's a futures market, a special dedicated emissions futures market. And we've seen that in the past operate as individual trades, but it's very efficient as companies find value in reducing their emissions below a certain level and allowing others to buy it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And it works. It achieves the goals. It's more efficient. It produces lower emissions than federal mandates, and it works.
And it creates a new opportunity in the marketplace.
There are these markets create hundreds
jobs.
Of millions of and new jobs over here. Even this whole thing on carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to talk about it now, but this whole issue of carbon sequestration is ginning up another sector worth many billions of dollars.
Right. You know, and Jim, so here's what I'm foreseeing. I'm looking in my Small Business Advocate crystal ball here now, and my audience knows that it's almost 100% perfect. I'm almost never wrong about these things, and so I'm seeing these 13 states being the origins of a new accord. You know, the Kyoto Accord is really not going to be not working. It's not all that workable. But this now we're going to I can see maybe like in 3 to 5 years, Jim, we have the Bangor Accords. What do you think?
I better write that down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or the
Manchester Accords, you know, or
right. Yeah. Yeah. It is very likely that this will serve as a good template for what will emerge as some sort of national policy and one that works, and whether our friends in Europe or South America want to go along, that's fine, or
right.
They don't, it's not. But this is likely something that we will see, and it will work.
Well, or, well, you know, they might even be called, with regard to, as it being an alternative to Kyoto, Jim, maybe we'll call them the na-na-na-na Accords. What do you think?
Or alternately,
not,
we told you
not to
you
stick
so.
Our finger in their eye too much.
Yes. No, that. That's a good idea.
I like that one. I like that, Jim.
Na-na-na-na-na.
Yeah, the na-na-na-na-na Accords.
We even have some good.
Or we can call it the Raspberry Accords. we're going to take a quick break, folks. We'll be right back. We'll be right back with our good friend Jim Ostroff after these messages. We've got to find out what some other things the states are up to. And we got more news to come up with after these messages. Stay with us. We're back at 17 till. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. Let me remind you, I'm going to be in New York City. I'm traveling today to New York City tonight. I'm going to be on the Joey Reynolds Show, WOR 710 on the AM dial from 1 to 2 Eastern Time. And I'll be doing my show tomorrow, just as always, but I'll be doing it from New York. And so I'm looking forward to that. Joey invited me to come up and do the show, and I appreciate him doing that. I'm looking forward to talking to all the folks in his audience. Quite a few folks, I think. He's been doing this a long time. He's one of the pioneers. So look for that if you get a chance. You can also, if you're in other parts of the country, you can, and you're not near their signal, you can listen on the internet. So check that out. Jim Ostroff is our guest. Jim, let's move. He's with Kiplinger Editors, by the way, folks. And as you know, the Kiplinger Editors have an outstanding website, Kiplinger.com. They've got their publications, the flagship Kiplinger letter, which comes every week. They've got the three biweekly letters, the tax letter, the agriculture letter, and the California letter. And then they've got a magazine called the Kiplinger Personal Finance Magazine. And, Jim, they can subscribe all that to all those at your website, can't they?
Oh, absolutely, yes. They can just go on www.kiplinger.com.
Right.
They can get information about all of those.
And also a lot of stuff there you don't have to subscribe to. There's a lot of good information there that you guys make available.
Oh, They do. At Kiplinger.com, or particularly, there is a wealth of things that is just off there. It's off the web. It is available.
Right. So check that out when you get a chance, folks. Okay. Jim, one more thing about what the states are doing is 14 states will soon have their own minimum wage above $5.15. Jim, this is very troubling to me.
It is a movement here, and of course, what that means is that companies doing business in those various states, such as Washington State, where the federal minimum, the state minimum wage is going up to $7.35 an hour, likely will find it sort of more difficult to operate.
Jim, here's my question. The moment that the minimum wage goes to $7.35 in Washington, what are employers supposed to do with the employees who were already at $7.35 because they had earned those raises, that level of income? They had earned a raise from whatever. They came in with no skills as a absolutely skillless person. Somebody gave them a job, brought them in a minimum wage. They worked hard. They kept their nose clean. They took initiative, and over a period of a year or so, maybe, they raised them to $7.35. And then the government comes in one day and says, okay, everybody gets this much. What does the employer do with that employee?
In the real world, what they do is say, we have little choice but to increase that person's
proportionally,
but also in individual cases, there are companies, especially small businesses, that say, you know, maybe we can do a little, but we cannot match that. We cannot afford it.
And so we lay somebody off. But here's the thing, though, Jim. If the government came in and said, you must not charge more than $45 for this tire, or you must pay at least $1,000 a month for rent, or you must, this has got, you know, you cannot make more than a 27.5% gross margin on this product. If the government came in and tried to tell us that, we would revolt. But this minimum wage thing is the same thing. That in my scenario that I just identified, that's the government coming in and saying, Jim Blassingame, if you're paying people below $7.35 an hour, you must increase your expenses by government fiat.
You must, and too bad. But it's more than just saying too bad. What that means, of course, is that there'll be less hiring, slower hiring.
Yep.
And that differential you talked about is really very important in the real world.
It's bad for morale, too.
It is. Someone said, but I worked and I sweated and I got up to $7.35 an hour. Now Joe or Jane, new person coming in here, first thing, they're making $7.35 an hour. How do I feel?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it does create problems, and it does affect, in a negative way, overall employment.
Folks, you'll be glad to know that I'm off my soapbox now. This is one of my soapbox. Jim, let's move on over and talk about health care. What are some of the new things going on with health savings accounts? Seems, according to you guys, there are some new IRS rules?
Well, there are. The IRS, their tax agency, has basically adopted some rules that effectively go and, you might say, reduce the appeal of health savings accounts, something that small companies in particular had been looking to with great interest to try to at least slow the dramatic increase in health care costs. And the IRS is saying that beginning in 2006, really just slightly more than a year away right now, that, you know, the companies, the plans who own these HSAs must pay 100% of the prescription drug costs until they meet various deductibles.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom line is that it makes these much less attractive
big
to
mistake.
Companies. Right. Companies who are hoping to offer this to their employees. Again, it is something that's done. It's done for companies, but it is done for workers, for employees.
We've got to get our hands around this. The different organizations, the lobbying organizations, the NFIB, the Small Business Entrepreneurship Council, have got to get their hands around this and stop this, because HSAs are one of the best things to happen to especially small businesses, and we can't let them do this. This is a big mistake. Quick break. We're going to be right back with Jim Ostroff after these messages. We got more to come. Stay with us.
This is your big debut. It's like a dream come true.
We're back at 7 till. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and we're visiting with our good friend Jim Ostroff. He's associate editor with the Kiplinger Editors at Kiplinger.com, and you can don't forget to check out their publications, which you can subscribe to, I should say. Jim, let's move over and talk about the savings rate dilemma that you guys report. Americans are notorious for not saving, aren't they?
That is correct. I mean, historically, their savings rate is lower than most other countries.
And Jim, if you look back on the last half a dozen years, all the way back to 98, really, when you know, we stood a chance in 98. A lot of people don't realize this. In 98, we stood a chance of having some serious global economic challenges, and the American consumer pulled us out. And in the early part of this decade, the American consumer did an awful lot to keep this country from going so far into the hole, and not only this country but the world. So in some ways, our poor savings rate actually has helped the global economy, hasn't it?
That's correct. It has kept the pump primed, and as you noted here, early in this century, in this decade, right after the terrible attacks of September 11th, there were many indications that the U.S. economy was going to go into a tailspin, and when the U.S. catches cold, the world gets pneumonia. There were some indications here about a serious world recession, but the U.S. consumer started spending and spending a lot more, and literally turned things around, kept the United States as well as most of the world from plunging into recession, and that's a fact.
But Jim, as long as saving and investment is taxed as it is, people are going to continue to do that. They're going to focus more on spending than they are on saving, because I mean, when you've got a passbook account that's getting low single digit interest rates, and then you get a little piddling amount of interest on your deposits, and then the government comes in and takes a chunk out of that, nobody's going to be interested in that.
Correct.
Not nearly as many people, I should say.
No, correct. And so what do they do but not spend money, but also spend it on other investments where they feel that they can get a slightly better return.
Well, we headed down this path, Jim. You remember this in the 70s with runaway inflation. There are 80 million baby boomers who came of age with double digit inflation. And there was no incentive to save. You were better off to buy because of the inflated dollars.
Oh, absolutely. And you saved it. If you saved at that point, no question, you were going to lose money.
That's right. And I mean, I have a great story that I'm not going to tell because it'd take too long. But it happened in my life. Me compared to a friend of mine who he saved, I didn't, and 5 years later, I was financially better off than he was with regard to a house. But the thing is, Jim, just as we are culturally very entrepreneurial, we are culturally not good savers.
We've not been for many, many decades. But you got to say, okay, so what's the result? Have our standards of living declined and crashed? Quite the opposite. So you look at the savings rate, and it has some implications, but it's not the end of the world. And you really, there are many more things to it. Just looking at savings rate is an empty exercise.
Right. And so the government, the answer, folks, is the government's got to get their mitts out of our savings and our investment and encourage people to do both of those. Jim, let's move down and talk about energy. I know this is an area that you're focusing on. Nuclear energy and wind power is a big deal now, right?
They are, and they will be more so in years ahead. And the reason being is we need more energy, and these are, you might say, in one way or other, rarely available sources. There are issues to deal with in both of them.
Well, you guys are predicting that we'll have two more nuclear plants by 2010.
We believe that is very likely. You have consortium of various utilities backed by suppliers that are moving ahead with this, and they are getting support from the Bush administration, actually, proceeding.
And wind power, the windmills are coming on, especially in Southern California and other parts of the country.
Southern California, the Great Plains, any place where there's a good chance the wind will blow offers opportunities.
They're ugly. They're ugly, but they're very efficient. No question about that. Jim Ostroff, thank you for being here. Good job today, and we'll see you next time.
Have a good one.
Jim Ostroff, ladies and gentlemen, with the Kiplinger Editors. He's a great guy. We'll have him back. I got to go for this hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and this program is for you.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blassingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.